through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Ross.
This hour of Tom, Jake, and Stacy is brought to you by Mercedes-Benz of Seattle. Seahawks head coach Pete Carroll spoke with the media yesterday for the first time since entering the bye week. One of my favorite moments is that we don't necessarily have here is that he called Snacks Harrison svelte, which is maybe something you've never heard combined with Snacks Harrison before. Kind of like calling me very tall or imposing, but I like it. Let's get started, though, with some of the updates you need to know. We'll go ahead and start with cut number three right here. Here's Pete Carroll updating us on the status of Jamal Adams.
We got to get through the week, see what happens. You know, give him these days and figure it out. Take full advantage of the time and make sure that we're doing the right thing and taking care of him and looking after him. It's a long season again. And we'd love to have him back as soon as we can get him, but we want him back when he's right and back for the long haul.
This was a bit weird to me, you guys, because we were told that Jamal Adams would be back after the bye. Maybe not definitively told that, but the assumption has always been he's going to be back sooner rather than later, and we're going to see him after the bye week, right? He wasn't placed on IR, which would sideline you for 3 weeks. So the assumption to me has always been like maximum 3 weeks being sidelined. I'm a bit surprised to hear what sounds to me like Pete Carroll backtracking just a little bit and saying, hey, we want to be totally safe. I don't really know what that's about, and I also don't know if it's just playing games, playing mind games with opposing defenses, or if you're really saying, like, we don't know if Jamal Adams is going to be ready this Sunday.
Well, it could be a little bit of both. I mean, I think that with Pete Carroll, whenever he is kind of playing coy like that, I don't like it because Pete is the ultimate optimist. So if Jamal was back healthy, raring to go, he would be saying that, being fired up about having Jamal back. So I think there's legitimacy into the question of whether Jamal is going to play or not, which is shocking because initially it was talked about a first-degree strain in his groin, and every player reacts differently in terms of how quickly they're able to get over that. And obviously it's a difficult place to have an injury when you're cutting and moving and trying to tackle and all that as explosively as Jamal Adams does. So I don't think that Pete's trying to play gamemanship here. I think that more than anything else, I think he's truly curious to see how Jamal Adams progresses over the next, 3 days here to really truly determine if he's going to be a part of this lineup.
You know, I have to admit, even though I've come to the light, okay, I admit I've come to the light on the Jamal Adams trade, this was one of my concerns when that trade was made. Is that when you give away too much, you never know if a player's going to get hurt. And you, how many games would he have to be absent, or how hobbled would he have to be before we start looking at that trade and saying, I don't know if that ended up benefiting us more than it ended up hurting us.
I think it would have to be...
It's a fair question.
It is. I think it would have to be significantly more. It also helps that he's 25. So this is a guy that you're getting for your future. You never would have had a sixth overall pick, which is where the Jets took him. So instead, you've got a guy. You gave up 2 first-round picks, but you've got a guy for the future of your organization. So I think it is a bit more long-term. It'll have to be something like if he's missing games next year and the year after, then you start to think, oh, that might not be worth it. But missing so far 2 games here isn't overly concerning to me. Although the fact that the weakness of your team is on defense certainly makes it a necessity that he return sooner, as opposed to a guy like Philip Dorsett would be a plus, but like, I'm not, breaking my neck looking, quickly to see over my shoulder whether or not he's, getting back to this team.
Right. But to answer that question, Tom, I think it would have to be at least another 3 more weeks. 3 more weeks of him being injured, and you're looking at least for this season, did it pay off for you this season? I think that starts to become in question. But as Pete Carroll mentioned in that cut, it's a long season. And when you bring somebody back of Jamal Adams' caliber, you want to make sure that it is for real and that he's there to stay. I think it's too early to try and force guys to be in that week-to-week mindset. That's a tough grind for, from week 6, game 6, all the way till the Super Bowl to have to really grind through and rehab hard every single week to just to get yourself ready to go. So I think that that's more of the approach that they're looking at here with Jamal Adams. I just hope, obviously, that it's quicker, it's sooner rather than later.
Yeah. Unfortunately, they need him for the next five games and not, say, the last five.
They do.
I don't need him against the Jets. I mean, as much as I want to see him play against his former team, the
I
Jets, they don't
really
want to
see that happen.
As much in that game, right? I mean, they need him now. And I'm not pointing the finger at anybody. An injury is an injury. But the reason why I came to the light in the first place is because I saw what he can do on the field, right, in the first couple of games and what he's actually capable of, the way he affects a game. And we asked the question yesterday, who do you want to see step up in the second half or after the bye? I chose him for all the same reasons. You know, I have a higher expectation of him, and I'm going to be a little bit harder on – or not harder on him, but I'll be more concerned if he's out, you know, for any reason.
Now, a couple guys could make their debuts. One you acquired recently, one was a draft pick. We'll go ahead and start with the former. And cut number four, here's Pete Carroll when asked whether or not Snacks Harrison is looking like he could make his debut.
Yeah, I'd like to really hold off on that one, you know, Adrian, until we get through this week, because this will be the first week he can really go. And got a new number and all that. It looks good. You know, he looks svelte. I'm excited just to get him out there and get him in the mix. We really haven't had a great look. We'll have a good padded practice this week that'll help, and we'll see how he's doing. But I'm excited. He's a great guy, and I hope that he can help us out and be part of it.
See, svelte. That right there, yeah, svelte. You know, he looks svelte in his New Jersey. That's a quote that doesn't surprise me, because when I think when you evaluate someone like Snacks Harrison, who is a large man, and you want to make sure that when he comes back after, you know, missing 4 weeks of the season, 5 weeks of the season, that you're not putting him at any risk whatsoever of injuring himself, because that would just be a waste of everybody's time. You want to make sure that he's in the best shape possible. I believe that this organization is happy with what Snacks has done over the bye to get him ready to go. But they, as Pete said, they've got to evaluate him this week and truly get that good look of him in a full padded practice in a full week before they decide to play him. So really, you're not going to get a decision on whether Snacks Harrison is going to be a part of this active roster until literally the last second of the end of the week.
You know, we were talking about trade scenarios last segment. I think I'd be more... I mean, they've already made a move. It's not a trade to get Harrison, but it is a move. I think he's as much a difference maker as some of those other guys that we discussed. In other words, being able to pick him up off the street, as we say, I think that this move is going to pay off in a much bigger way than your average just mid-season free agent pickup, because he is at a position of need, and he's been a terrific player throughout his career. So I'm pretty big on this move, and it's not just because he's a former Giant. I think this is an excellent acquisition. I mean, when the camera pointed to him up in the up in one of the suites the other day when he wasn't playing but the Seahawks were, and he was just watching the game, I mean, he just had a look on his face like, yeah, I want to get in there. I want to get in there. I'm ready to get in there and help this team, and I can't wait to see him out there.
Tom Pelissero, by the way, just under a half hour ago, said that the Dolphins recently tried to sign Snacks Harrison off the Seahawks practice squad, which you can do at any time as long as that player goes on your active roster immediately. But Snacks declined, just as he did with the Bucks, still ramping up toward joining Seattle's active roster, says Pelissero. That's a pretty good sign.
No, it is a good sign.
He didn't want to go to Miami?
Well, no, that he had a chance to go immediately to an active roster and declined in order to stay on Seattle's practice squad for right now, because he knows that
right. You're
going to go on the active roster. That's his assumption, that you're going to be on the active roster maybe sooner rather than later. Not only that, but that you'd rather play for Seattle than play for Miami.
Absolutely. And look, everybody wants to get paid. There's no question about that. But Snacks Harrison is also in the unique position where he's gotten a couple big contracts already. So the money isn't everything to him at this point. So what's the difference between, is he that anxious to play that he's going to leave 1 week early for an active game week check than versus stay on the practice squad for 1 week if the Seahawks deemed that, hey, he just needs one more week to get himself in the best position? He joined this team for a reason. He's after a Super Bowl. He believes that this organization has the best chance to help him get there. And as Tom mentioned, he absolutely wants to get in the mix and be a part of this.
Let's get to another potential debut. This one, maybe you've heard the name, Daryl Taylor. Yep, that was the Seahawks' second round pick from earlier this year.
Who?
I know. That's a fair question. Daryl Taylor, Jim Nagy, when he joined our show after the draft, said that he looks like a Seahawk. He is in the mold of Frank Clark. He's a guy the Seahawks were clearly really excited about, particularly his potential. He was a little bit raw, and he was coming off of an injury and surgery to repair a stress fracture in his leg. So he had that earlier this year. He has started the season on the NFI list, did not participate in training camp, has not made his debut with the Seahawks. And cut number five right here, he's asked, hey, is Daryl Taylor going to actually play for the Seahawks this season?
Really, Joe, I've watched him run. I was out there with him a couple times this week. He looks like he's running hard and fast and pushing it. He's really strong right now. I don't, anything could happen from this point forward, but he's working really hard. There's, the docs are taking, really good care of him and making sure we don't force the issue too soon. Just judging from what I'm seeing, he looks like he's made great progress. He's not like he's waiting to start getting in shape and all that. He's fit and strong. He hasn't done as much change of direction stuff that's really hard on him at this point, but he's really running hard and looks good.
Y'all, I think it's way too early and unfair also to compare Daryl Taylor to Malik McDowell, who also never made his Seahawks debut. I understand why people are worried about it. I understand why fans are worried. Hey, you have a second-round pick that was almost your first-round pick. John Schneider told Danny and Gallant that he almost decided to draft Taylor in the first round rather than Jordan Brooks, but they went with Brooks. But it could very well have been Daryl Taylor. I know why people are nervous and why they flash back to those injured players. I think it's way too early, but this isn't great news.
Yeah, I don't think of Malik McDowell. I mean, that's a whole different level of...
That was self-inflicted.
Let me tell you what, those comments are out there. It's not a fair comparison, but it's being made.
Well, go ahead and say that. But you're way off base if you're trying to compare him to Malik McDowell. You're way off base. This is more of an LJ Collier comparison. This is more of an Rashad Penny comparison of guys that are getting injured and not being able to contribute their rookie season. More LJ than Rashad, because Rashad got out there a little bit. But it is concerning when you have a guy like Daryl Taylor, who they are very high on, who cannot get himself out on the field. And I don't care what Mike Salk says, that this group was relying on Daryl Taylor in their initial plans of building their roster to be out there, to be able to contribute, to be able to be a part of that pass rushing equation. And when you try to parse through what Pete is saying there, it sounds really positive, right? But the one huge negative is saying that the most difficult thing for him at this point is the change of direction stuff. Well, that's playing football. Change of direction is playing football. Change of direction is being able to capture the edge and bend the edge to get around the tackle to make the sack on the quarterback. Those are the things that are the legit next step to you actually playing football. So if he's running sprints and he's staying in shape that way, that's great. But not being able to make change of direction moves or football moves at this point is very concerning.
Do either one of you remember
No.
if it was explained at all what the Seahawks said they were told about Daryl Taylor's injury?
They didn't say what they were told. They only said that Daryl Taylor, they were one of the few teams, and Daryl Taylor was one of the few players, they were able to have visit their facility before quarantine, because that happened pretty early in the process. And so they thought that they benefited not only from their own doctors being able to look at Daryl Taylor, but from other teams not getting a chance to look at Daryl Taylor. So they were like, we think that might have been another reason he slid to us or didn't go as early, is because other teams didn't get the chance to actually examine him.
Well, I'm just, okay, that makes some sense. But I'm wondering what they were told by their own physicians or by whoever else about how early he'd be ready to come back, because whatever information they had, I mean, if they were told that he was going to be out this long, would they have still drafted him? I agree. I think that they were relying on him to some extent to play this year. I mean, yeah, he's a rookie, but I mean, would they have drafted him if they thought that, I mean, would any team draft any player if they thought that that player would not be able to play at all in their first year? I think the answer is no.
The Dallas Cowboys
most of
did
the
it.
Time.
They did it. They did it with Jalen him. Smith with Jalen Smith, who is their starting Mike linebacker. But that is a rare, rare case.
Extremely
to give
rare.
Up, you know, significant capital, but it has been done. But with Daryl Taylor, no, they didn't anticipate that he would be hurt. And Pete actually explained it that COVID really messed up, really, really messed up his rehabilitation process. That he looked like he was, you know, doing great before that, and really everything got sidetracked to the point where we're at where we're at right now, and he cannot perform for the Seattle Seahawks right now, which is a huge disappointment at this time.
All right, we'll get back to a bit of this sound later in the halftime show, but first let's get to four down territory.
This is Four Down Territory
with Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
You live for moments like this. Time for us to step up and take it.
Jake, which Arizona Cardinal player does the Seahawks offense need to be concerned about?
Normally, I would be saying Chandler Jones. Chandler Jones being one of the best sack artists in the entire NFL. Chandler Jones, who absolutely would demolish Russell Wilson a couple different times throughout the season last year, particularly the second game at CenturyLink Field last season. Not going to have to worry about him. He tore his bicep and is out for the remainder of the season. But the guy that the Seahawks offense has to be concerned about and watch and try and control and limit his playmaking ability is Buda Baker. Safety Buda Baker, who the Arizona Cardinals paid big, big money to over the offseason. People were wondering what was going on. Why would they pay him that much money if he didn't have an interception? Well, he got his first interception this last game against the Dallas Cowboys, but he brings the juice. He brings the energy. He plays the game that any old school football player would be proud of. I mean, he flies around, reckless abandon, hitting guys, blitzing the quarterback. He plays very similarly to Jamal Adams, to be honest with you, but just has the ability to play more of a free safety role as well as his strong safety responsibility. So if Buda Baker is flying around and making big hits and able to get to the quarterback and getting tackles for loss, that defense is going to get energized. They need to limit Buda Baker's impact in this game.
Second down. Colby Parkinson's returning from the NFI list. Stacy, how soon do the Seahawks need to make a decision on him, and what does that mean for the tight end group?
So Colby Parkinson and DJ Reed are two players right now coming back from the NFI list. There's a couple other guys on there. Daryl Taylor, who we just talked about, also on there, though it doesn't sound like he's returned to practice officially. So once you are taken off of a list, whether it's PUP, NFI list, which are both similar, one happens inside of the team's football operations, the other outside of it, you have 3 weeks to be activated or you are placed on the injured reserve. So Colby Parkinson now has 3 weeks to practice. They'll see if they can activate him. From everything that Pete Carroll has said, it sounds so far like he's looked great in practice. I think that this is someone that could impact someone like Jacob Hollister or Luke Wilson for different reasons. Jacob Hollister, potentially a trade piece for Seattle if they decide that Colby Parkinson, who they drafted to be a tight end for their future, is ready to go. He's a big body. He's like 6'7", had great hands in college, and he could be a guy, if he's ready to go, that jumps right in there. And, you know, if he is ready before November 3rd, which is the trade deadline, maybe they look at trading someone like Jacob Hollister, who is a fantastic offensive weapon. And right now they have a bevy of talent at tight end. For Luke Wilson, it could mean, you know, you're an older veteran and you get, you know, bumped off the active roster. It doesn't have to mean that. there could be an injury or someone that gets moved to IR anyways, that Colby Parkinson is just activated right into his spot. But right now, you've got a bit of a crowded room at tight end, and so I think those are two names to be watching for.
Third down. Jake, are the Arizona Cardinals that good, or were the Dallas Cowboys that bad after watching last night's game?
The Dallas Cowboys are legitimately that bad. I mean, it was brutal to watch this group on both sides of the ball. Andy Dalton disappointed. He looked oftentimes like he didn't really know what was going on out there. Double clutching, nervous to make the big throw. It was really unique to see a guy who has so much playing experience and so much success in this league to, you know, come out and play that way. So I'm not sure what was going on there, but defensively, the Dallas Cowboys are an absolute mess. And I think that the Arizona Cardinals could have beat them by a couple more touchdowns had Kyler Murray not missed a guy here or there. So I see this more as the Dallas Cowboys having major issues at this point of the season. They're getting worse and worse and worse as the season progresses. But the Arizona Cardinals, when you get wins like this and you build confidence, a team like Arizona becomes that much more dangerous as they are building confidence within each other, as they are a newly collected group, batch of guys on this on 2020's roster.
Fourth down. After further study, I assume your study, what do the Seahawks yes. need to do to fix their troubling third down conversion rate? That's troubling?
Yes, Uh-oh. It is. They are one of the worst in the NFL offensively in third down conversions. I mean, as great as their offense has been, this has been a real weak point for them. And when I investigated further, because it was driving me nuts trying to figure out why they're so poor and why they're ranking so low, is because they've got themselves too often in third and long situations, particularly against the Minnesota Vikings. That really hurt them. But if you knock off their third and long situations, they're in third and mediums, meaning third and six or less, their percentage is skyrockets. And they are, you know, towards the top of the league in third and medium and third and short. So you got to try and limit those third and long situations. You have to be more effective, or at least not have negative plays on first and second down.
All right. If you missed the show, you can always listen to it via the 710 Sports app powered by Dubin Law Group. What are we going to figure out about the Seahawks over the next 5 weeks? Plus, should Seattle make a trade before November 3rd's deadline? We'll figure that out in the halftime show next.
It's time for the halftime show.
The half is not over. There's 3 seconds on the clock.
Revisiting the biggest stories of today at the midpoint of the show.
The halftime show. It's not easy.
Now, here's Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
It's the halftime show. Going back over the top stories we've had today, let's go ahead and get started with our top story. The next 5 weeks will tell us everything we need to know about the Seattle Seahawks. That's according to us, at least. I think that we're going to learn whether or not this defense will cost you a Super Bowl. This is the toughest part of your schedule. Competition in the postseason is only going to get harder. And if you can't keep Kyler Murray at bay, and you can't keep Jared Goff at bay, and if you let them run all over you, I mean, metaphorically, figuratively speaking, obviously they would be passing, then how are you going to keep out, you know, Aaron Rodgers? How are you going to keep away Tom Brady? What are you going to do against Drew Brees if the Saints make it in there? I mean, it will only get harder from here. You look at what the Seahawks defense has been allowing, 471.2 net yards per game, which would break a record. Currently, they're in last place in the league. They're also last place in passing yards per game, allowing 370, almost 371 pass yards. So your defense has a chance to get better. I think Jamal Adams returning is going to help you. Quentin Dunbar being healthier, that growing confidence in the secondary is going to help you. But it needs to happen in the next 5 weeks. That's the toughest part of your schedule, the biggest test. And I have all the confidence in the world in this offense. The defense, though, has a lot to prove.
What I said over the next 5 weeks that you're going to have to look for, and I think you're absolutely right, Stacey, the defense, you're going to learn a whole lot about this team. In the next 5 weeks, is going to determine Russell Wilson's MVP campaign. he's going to go up against some of the tougher passing defenses in the league. You've got two of the Rams have the fourth fewest yards rendered in the passing game. The 49ers have the fifth fewest. Cardinals, 11th fewest. And then you've got the Rams and the Cardinals, who are amongst the best in the NFL. They're top 10 in the NFL in sacks. So you're going to get more pressure. You're going to face better units in terms of pass defense. And if Russell Wilson and the Seahawks can continue to win despite that and continue to play well and put up big numbers, you can pretty much wrap up and put a bow on the MVP campaign for Russell Wilson.
What if he played better, but the team ended up losing?
Why, Tom? Would you say that?
The only reason I ask that is because for people who are bent on looking at these individual statistics like passing yards given up or gained in order to explain what whether or not a team is truly great, I think that that's just the wrong approach. I mean, we're going to find out whether or not the Seahawks are elite or not based on two things, wins and losses and nothing else. And by the way, those other teams will figure out the same things about themselves. Nothing is etched in stone going forward, even if the Seahawks were to go, say, 1-4. But the picture will come more into focus, nevertheless, going forward. How much better are the Seahawks than these other teams? Or how much closer are these other teams to them? That we'll find out.
Look, I know that we're going to be looking at wins and losses here, but let me tell you about the Seahawks defense in the red zone over the first 5 weeks of the season. 75% allowed versus Atlanta, 60% versus New England, 100% versus Dallas. You bettered that to 33% against Miami. That's fantastic. But then right back up to 75% allowed in the red zone versus Minnesota. Goal to go, 100%, 60%, 100%. No attempts at goal to go for Miami, and then 100%, 3 of 3 for Minnesota. I know it's a bend but don't break, but they've been breaking too. So even though they don't lead the league in points allowed, a very important category, to me, the wins are because your offense and Russell Wilson have been putting up big points. Your defense is allowing them, though.
They are, and yes, the wins and losses are what matters most, but also the stats, they do paint a picture. They do paint a picture, and they do show weaknesses and strengths. Every game is different. And, you know, when you look at those stats that, Stacey, you just rattled off, there's a couple, you know, texts that I've seen on the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line here at 710-710 saying, hey, we've got Russell Wilson. It doesn't matter. Well, you might have the best player in the NFL, but how much room for error are you going to give this guy, right? And I think that the room for error right now is razor thin for the Seattle Seahawks. They've been able to win despite that. And so hopefully they will continue to keep getting better, continue to keep improving, because they're going to need better performances on both sides of the ball. Yes, even the offensive side of the ball, to continue to win these next 5 weeks.
Next up, we talked about potential trade targets for the Seattle Seahawks. Tom, I'm going to read you a couple names Jake suggested. Julio Jones, Kenny Galladay, A.J. Green, Odell Beckham Jr., Zach Ertz, Grady Jarrett, Ryan Kerrigan, J.J. Watt, your personal fave outside of Jared Goff, Carlos Dunlap, Geno Atkins. What do you think about those guys?
I love them all. I think we should trade for every one of them.
You got it.
I think they should all start. I think they should displace whoever currently is at those positions. No. I don't want any more wide receivers. I'll tell you that much. If you want to give up whatever you want to give up for some of these defensive players, J.J. Watt is not a trade I'm excited about, not because I don't like him. I do. But clearly his health is – I mean, he's not going to be here for very long. And when I say here, I mean like
it's
in
dark.
The league.
You don't mean like on – okay.
His career is coming to an end pretty soon. So, I mean,
so
it's not like
weird.
You're trading for him. He's going to be here forever. But no, I don't think we need any more wide receivers. Maybe I like Zach Ertz. That's interesting to me. If you could somehow move Jacob Hollister with a draft pick or whatever, that would be interesting to me. He's still a relatively young player. But the rest of them, Grady Jarrett, I like an awful lot. Olivier Vernon, I like, but I'm not sure where you're going to play him. So,
He goes into a rotation with Benson Mayoa. He goes into a rotation with
Olivier
Benson
Vernon?
Mayoa. Defensive. Yeah. He's a pass rusher.
I thought he was a linebacker.
I forgot Vernon.
He is a linebacker, but he's one of those 3-4 outside linebackers that
like
specializes in rushing the passer. Yeah, like Von Miller, like Clowney, you know, so he would fit in that role. But to me, I would love to see them add on the defensive side of the ball. Obviously, pass rush is their biggest need. Any one of those players are big-time playmakers and would instantly upgrade them. But don't underestimate the idea of them adding to their offense. And you can look at it and say, Jake, oh, you're a quarterback all you want. But if you can't legitimately find the right trade partner defensively, what is the next best thing that you can do? Continue to add and continue to give this offense more weaponry. That's why they signed Josh Gordon. If Josh Gordon is not able to come on this team for whatever reason, we've already gotten to a point where we're wondering what the heck is going on with Josh Gordon. Well, if he's not able to sign and the NFL's not willing to reinstate him, then maybe you do need that third weapon, that dynamic player that puts defenses and people in the NFC West, even with these great defense, in a bind to say, okay, we're going to double DK Metcalf. Okay, well, what are you going to do with Tyler Lockett? What are you going to do if Julio Jones or Kenny Galladay or A.J. Green or Odell Beckham Jr. are on the field, right? So, again, these are all hypothetical conversations, but don't dismiss it.
Jake, instead of our final story here, because we only have a couple seconds, I'm going to make a PSA on your behalf. Are you ready for this?
Yes.
Okay. I would like everyone to know that Jake did have a COVID test the other day. He does not have COVID. I have seen the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line blowing up all day. Jake, are you okay? Jake, go get tested. Jake has been tested. He's fine. He just has a stuffy nose, and we shouldn't be making fun of him.
Everyone, just take it very easy. Okay.
Jake is played through the pain right now, and he is being a champion for us. Okay? Stop making fun of Jake.
Oh, my gosh. You're so mean. I hate you right now. But, yes, for everybody on the text line that has been blowing up the text line asking if I have a cold or am I okay,
I do
end up getting tested regularly covering the Seahawks. I'm fine, and I'm just playing through it. I'm playing hurt right now, so let's all bear with it.
Bear with it. Sorry, that's the last time.
Stacey,
I'm done now. I'm done. The timeline is next.
This is The Timeline
with Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
Brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
It's The Timeline. I'm Tom, Jake, and Stacey reading you the top stories you're going to see on your own Twitter timelines. If you see any you ever want us to include, by the way, before I get started here, go ahead and tag us at Stacey Rost, at JT Heaps 9, at Tom Wassel. Curtis is laughing. I don't even want to ask why. I will. We use Teams during our show prep. And Jake, so that you know, one of my biggest fears, because we mute it right before we come back, is that when I mute it, and you can see, by the way, our team stream on 710sports.com. You can watch it. When I mute it, I always worry that that's when you and Curtis grow closer as friends, because we have a fight between me and Jake where we try to see which of us can be better friends with Curtis. And I always fear that when I mute it, that's when you and Curtis share all your secrets and say, like, okay, I love you, bro, and then you go on air.
And then, like, oh, my gosh, can you believe Stacey right now?
Yeah, like, I always, you know when you have, like, a trio of friends and you're like, am I the one that when I leave the room, that's
the
when all the best
talk
friendship?
About the other one?
Oh, I can't believe this other person's around. Yes.
It's the worst. All right. Anyways, Buda Baker had a huge game on Monday Night Football, and it was a reminder, a sad reminder to Seahawks fans of what could have been, you guys, because the Seahawks passed on him three times and instead drafted Malik McDowell, something pointed out by our colleague Brock Heward. Guys, I don't want to be the one to bring it up, but it's been rotten up. Are you sad all over again? Do you like that? I did what I can.
Yes. Incredible.
Thank
incredible.
You so much.
Yes, it does make you sad. And also to know that the Seahawks traded back multiple times, and one of the other names that was in position for the Seahawks to draft was TJ Watt.
Yep.
Between Buda Baker, TJ Watt, and us getting Malik McDowell instead of those two, yes, it does make me sad and it makes me frustrated, because either one of those players would be unbelievably fun to watch them in a Seahawk uniform.
In order to be mad, though, at the team or frustrated that they didn't do that, you're what, accusing them of misevaluation beforehand? Is that what it is?
I think that's part of the assumption for some people, yeah, is that there was some kind of...
Because
here's the thing, and that is a great point, Tom, because part of it is the Malik McDowell injury was a freak accident. How could you have foreseen it?
Yeah, I mean, what if they evaluated Malik McDowell properly, but then he goes out and does this thing? I mean, look, the draft is imperfect. Being that it's imperfect, and guys who are commonly drafted lower end up becoming better players than the guys drafted higher at the same position, the fact that that's common, I mean, if I chose to feel bad about every time that were the case, I'd go insane. Like, whatever. Like, we're moving on. I can't feel bad about that now.
Well,
he's a good player. I mean, what do you want?
He is a great player. He's a great player that the Seahawks could have had on their roster. Say with T.J. Watt.
Okay,
he's
well, you can't get every good player in the draft, though, Jake.
I know that, Tom. I do know that. I'm not saying they will, and obviously they haven't with the way that they've drafted over the last 4 or 5 years. That's not what I'm saying. But when you talk about fans being able to look back at drafts and seeing where they missed and wondering where, man, if this guy could have been a part of this roster, how different or how fun would it be? Yeah, I think every fan has the right to do that. Now, am I going and banging down, you know, John Schneider and Pete Carroll's door and saying these guys got to be run out of town for missing that? No. But I do think that it is unfortunate when you knew that Malik McDowell did have personal issues, that there were some red flags surrounding Malik McDowell, and you know, they went ahead and made that decision anyway. You can't foresee an accident like this, but there was something to that.
If you want to go back and, like, pick out one guy who you can say, you know what, that guy could have made a big, big difference for the Seahawks, and maybe Buda Baker's that guy, that's fine. But I think this, as an exercise, going back all the time and pointing out everybody they missed on each year, I just think that's just a mistake. I'm sorry. I just don't understand that mentality.
Yeah, one of those debates that could go on forever. I'm going to push past it because we can get back to it later. But I have some other stories I want to get you guys to sound off on. This next one is about the Astros, which I could talk about all day also. Ex-Astros GM, that's hard to say, Jeff Luhnow, again denied his role in the sign-stealing scandal. Wow, what a surprise. He told ESPN, quote, "It's pretty clear who was involved in the video decoding scheme, when it started, how often it happened, and basically when it ended. And it's also pretty clear who was not involved," implying that he wasn't. I don't know why that information wasn't discussed in the ruling or wasn't used. The people who were involved that didn't leave naturally to go to other teams are all still employed by the Astros. And then he continues to defend himself and says, "In fact, I had demoted from a position in the clubhouse someone who was promoted back into the clubhouse that had," he says, "more to do with it." So he's saying someone was guilty of being part of the scheme. I demoted them, and then they were promoted once I left. So again, kind of dodging any innocence then or any guilt. Then this is actually one of my favorite parts. Rob Manfred, who has been panned for his handling of this, actually clapped back a little bit and said the 22,000 electronic messages that Jeff talked about over and over again were a fraction of the evidence in this case. There was a lot of other evidence which indicated Jeff's culpability in this matter. Secondly, whether or not he knew exactly what was going on is really beside the point, because after the Apple Watch incident, I wrote to all the GMs, put them on notice that it was their obligation to make sure their organizations were not violating any sign-stealing rules, and I think it's pretty clear from the facts that Mr. Luhnow failed to discharge that obligation. He damaged the game, and as a result, he was disciplined. I kind of like that. I like that move from Rob Manfred.
He makes a good point. I mean, whatever... whether or not Jeff Luhnow, like, participated in any of this, and he points to that 22,000 electronic messages or whatever. So without knowing the specifics of what was in those messages, I guess we don't know what Luhnow was complicit in. But the ultimate question is your GM responsible for this if it's going on, whether he's directly involved or not? I think that's a debatable issue. I mean, does that mean that the GM should assume responsibility for any wrongdoing underneath him, or is there like a line that gets crossed when ultimately it's like, okay, well, you got to take the fall for this. And how is that defined? I don't really know. Since this was a team thing and it was started by Alex Cora, or that's at least what we've been led to believe, I just personally don't believe that he couldn't have known or that he wouldn't have known about it. So I'll say yes in this case. That doesn't mean that a GM should across the board be held responsible for everything a team or an individual does. But in this case, I'm thinking yes.
Yeah, I think that this organization was uniquely connected from the top to bottom, and their efforts to win games at all costs makes me believe that they were in the mindset that there was strict knowledge and communication across, you know, the entire board. And you have Rob Manfred, who is coming out and clearly stating that, no, this is actually a lie. And for a commissioner to do that, to be so frustrated, I think because he's gotten raked over the coals for the way that he's handled this Houston Astros situation, he's like, no. You are not going to get off here. You are not going to be able to try and separate yourself and not be one of the bad guys in this scenario. You were a part of it. I have evidence. I have proof. And so I do appreciate Rob Manfred, you know, sticking up for himself a little bit there.
I don't know what your guys' weeks look like if they're really busy. I know I have to finish putting my closet together. I got to take the trash out. Got a quick phone call. So in my mind, I'm pretty swamped. But none of us are coming anywhere close to what Joe Buck is going to be doing. This is his schedule. This dates back to this past Sunday. So on Sunday, he had Bucks Packers. Monday, he had the call for Bills Chiefs. Today, he's got World Series Game 1. Tomorrow, World Series Game 2. Thursday, Giants Eagles. Friday, World Series Game 3. Saturday, World Series Game 4. He will have 7 games, calling 7 games in 7 days. Joe Buck, the champ.
That is absolutely incredible. A, the first thought is this dude is getting paid right now. Absolutely getting paid. And B, that is one heck of a roller coaster for him to be doing that. And he's a true pro in every sport that he calls. I mean, hats off to him. It's unbelievable.
I can just see the text rolling in right now. I hate Joe Buck. I hate Joe Buck.
What?
He hates the Seahawks.
Who hates
I hate
Joe Buck?
Oh, yeah.
He's not Troy Aikman.
He's definitely not Troy Aikman.
No one is, Jake. He's so great.
Text in right now, 710-710, the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line. Do you like Joe Buck or do you dislike him?
Why would you dislike Joe Buck? Joe Buck makes fun of himself all the time.
I don't dislike Joe Buck at all. I think he actually sounds kind of dumb when he tries to be funny. I think he's actually a naturally funny guy when
yeah.
he's not trying too hard, but he does try too hard a lot. So, but we'll see. We'll see what the reaction is.
Joe Buck is fantastic. I love him. I get why some people criticize different commentators, and I get everyone's notes, but he is one of the best in the game in my mind. We all hate Joe Buck. Stacy. Okay, wow. Okay, text line has spoken. All right. ESPN's Brady Henderson. That's a real text. ESPN's Brady Henderson joins us next. What can we expect from Jamal Adams this weekend, if anything? Are we going to see Snacks Harrison? What's the latest for the Seahawks defensive development? We'll ask Brady all of those questions next on Tom, Jake, and Stacy.